This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What legacy is Sarah Palin leaving in the state of Alaska now that she's decided to resign as governor and hand power over to the lieutenant governor, Sean Parnell, on July 26th? My guest, Michael Carey, has been following her for years. He's a columnist for the Anchorage Daily News and its former editorial page editor. He also moderates a weekly program about state politics called Anchorage Edition on Alaska Public Broadcasting. After Palin's surprise speech on Friday, most people were still unsure why she resigned and whether she planned to leave politics or prepare a presidential campaign. She still hasn't said what she sees as her political future or if she even wants one. Yesterday, she said she resigned because of the time and costs of the ethics complaints against her and politically ambitious state legislators who were making it difficult for her to get anything done. Michael Carey, welcome back to Fresh Air. You wrote an op-ed piece that was published in the LA Times, and you wrote that the only thing we can be absolutely sure of is this: Palin did not tell the truth when she said she's leaving for the good of Alaskans. She's leaving for her own good. What makes you say that?
I think it's demonstrable in the sense that this is of course, there'll be a new governor, and the actual handoff will be pretty seamless. There are provisions for that, whether at the federal level or our level. But she has decided that, essentially, I can't do this job anymore. I don't want to do this job anymore. She presented it repeatedly, or a number of times in the text, that she's only trying to do what's good for the American people and for the Alaskan people. But I think when we find out more, and we don't have all the information, we're going to find out that she felt there was some advantage in this for her to leave, whether it was I don't have to be governor anymore, whether it was to go out and make a lot of money, whether it was just to stay home. But she presented this as a selfless decision done for others. And I guess, just as somebody who's been up here a while and has some opinions and been in the room with her and interviewed her on the radio and a variety of other things, I just don't believe that. She gave 2 weeks' notice like she was, you know, working at the department store or whatever.
Sarah Palin resigned during the week that the Todd Purdom Vanity Fair piece about her was published, a very unflattering piece. Todd Purdom wrote this about McCain's campaign team. He said, most made it clear that they suffer a kind of survivor's guilt. They can't quite believe that for two frantic months last fall, they worked their tails off to try to elect as vice president of the United States someone who by mid-October they believed for certain was nowhere near ready for the job and might never be. I think as an expert on Alaska politics, probably you were interviewed by a lot of people and spoke to a lot of people during the presidential campaign. Did you have any clue that people in the McCain campaign had become so disillusioned with Sarah Palin?
Occasionally you would hear rumblings, but they tended to be more like, I know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy who told me the McCain people were really upset with Sarah Palin because something she said, something she did. There were rumors that she'd had tantrums with the staff. I mean, these things were, I suspect they go on with many candidates, the suggestion being that the candidate is much different in private than she or he is in person. But I was in St. Paul when she was actually nominated and accepted the nomination in that electrifying speech. And for myself, I guess I'm going to quote that great authority, Mike Carey, I thought that the choice was very cynical because she simply wasn't prepared to be president of the United States by any rational definition.
Let me quote something Sarah Palin said in her speech, and she was referring to ethics complaints against her. And this seemed to be one of the reasons why she was leaving. She said, every one of the 15 ethics complaints have been dismissed. We have won. It hasn't come cheap. The state has wasted thousands of hours of our time and shelled out some $2 million of your dollars to respond to opposition research. And that's money that's not going to fund teachers or troopers or safer roads.
It's important to remember that most of the money that was spent on ethics complaints was spent on Troopergate, which was a major incident, as you remember, last summer and last fall, involving questions about how her brother-in-law was treated, how she handled the Department of Public Safety. That was not a trivial event. It was very divisive and very expensive and probably was important after a while to get to the bottom of it. I spoke to a former legislator today, former member of the Attorney General's staff, and he explained that many of these ethics complaints could have been answered simply by writing a letter back to those who handle ethics matters and say, gentlemen and ladies, this is actually what I did, and respond to the complaint in that fashion without requiring any high-priced legal help. Now, perhaps if you have aspirations to be president of the United States, you feel that you need high-priced legal help frequently or all the time, or you're not going to let these things go unanswered professionally. You want a professional in the room when you're answering them. I think there's something I want to add here, and that is really disappointing to those who had so much hope for Sarah Palin when she became governor, is she's really become professional at playing the victim. Somebody's saying terrible things about me. Somebody's saying terrible things about my family, and isn't it terrible? This is something you hear from her repeatedly.
What condition would you say Sarah Palin leaves the state of Alaska in?
Well, there was a story the other day, a national story, that said more than half the states in the United States are facing deficits. We are not, primarily because the price of oil went back up and is funding most of our budget in the billions, the low billions. But we also, of course, have a lot of federal spending that's coming in here. And we've used some reserves from something called the Budget Reserve Fund to balance the budget. But Sarah Palin did not have to impose on us, as happened in other states, new taxes or dramatic cuts in services. In fact, thanks to the Obama administration, which, of course, she's made mock of from time to time, we received a great deal of stimulus money that's a great help with our budget.
Sarah Palin wanted to give back about a third of the stimulus package that was being offered to Alaska. What was the reaction in Alaska when she wanted to give it back?
I think at first there was confusion. Why do you want to do this? And second, I mean, at the same time, there were some people who supported the governor. I think she was in better shape in public opinion then, who may have felt, yeah, well, maybe she's got a point here. Let's see what the government has in mind. And she asserted there were all these strings attached that would prevent us from doing things, quote, in the Alaskan way, unquote. On the other hand, there were many people, including legislators, who said, hey, it's free federal money. Get it? It's free. And some of the cynics said, you know, the Alaskan people have never seen a federal dollar that they didn't like, as we are historically one of the primary recipients of federal money. So eventually, I can tell you this from firsthand observation, I was in the legislature in Juneau visiting the state capitol when the state Senate leaders held a press conference to talk about the stimulus money, and they weren't nasty, they weren't unpleasant, but essentially Senate President Gary Stevens said, the President of the United States has spoken, he's giving out this money, maybe I wouldn't have voted for it if I was a senator, but I think we have an obligation to take all this money and spend it in the best way we can for all Alaskans. And that really was the essence of the way the legislature felt about it. And probably if they had a veto session today, they're prevented by the mechanics of how the legislature works. It would probably be like 55-5 in favor of taking the money.
When Sarah Palin officially steps down, the governor will be the now lieutenant governor, Sean Parnell. Tell us something about Sean Parnell and his record.
Sean Parnell is the son of a former member of the legislature. He's in his 40s. I've met him many times as editorial board editor and had him in as a guest. He will be much better liked by the Republican legislators and the legislature in general because he was a state senator before he became a member of the legislature. So he comes out of that tribe and knows what's expected in the way of treating the members of that tribe to keep them, if somewhat happier, let's say, or just to have a civil dialogue. He's not going to engage in the kind of alienation that Palin did. On the other hand, he is not a particularly dynamic leader. That's well known. He's polite to a fault. Don Young defeated him, Congressman Don Young, in a primary election last year. Young was very weak, very vulnerable. He was in his 70s. There were all these allegations of corruption. And Young came out fighting. He called Parnell Captain Zero and because of his lack of dynamism. And the nickname stuck. Parnell lost, went back to being lieutenant governor, and now he's about to be governor. And my guess is that he will be perceived as vulnerable by other Republicans and Democrats, and we're going to have a huge field of candidates during the next gubernatorial election.
What does Sean Parnell stand for politically?
He's a conservative Republican, law and order conservative Republican, fiscal responsibility. He showed that as a state senator to the extent that he could get his agenda through. And I think that will be similar here, anti-abortion, gun rights, the tradition of the right.
When Sarah Palin returned to Alaska after her defeat in the 2008 election, do you think she was a changed person, either observing her as a person or, you know, her political leadership style?
As a person, I would make this observation. I don't think anybody could run for vice president or president and play at that level in national, international politics and be at the center of the world and not have it in some way change you. That may just be self-evident. I can't prove it, but it seems that would have to be the case. As far as leadership goes, she was much more contentious, much more argumentative, and much more pushing back, I think is the way maybe we ought to phrase it, that whenever there was criticism, she just wouldn't ignore it. And some of the fights she picked were very minor with talk show hosts and others who really weren't of very much significance and bloggers. She could have just ignored them. I know that's hard for people to do in general when they feel abused or insulted, but there are times to pick your battles, and she certainly didn't seem to be very good at that when she got back here.
In the Todd Purdom piece, he mentioned something that I figure you know a lot about. He writes that perhaps nothing caused a bigger stir than her nomination of Wayne Anthony Ross to be Alaska's attorney general. And Purdom says that Ross had called gays and lesbians degenerates. And this was the first time in Alaskan history that a cabinet nominee was actually rejected. Tell us the story of this nomination and why it was so controversial.
Wayne Anthony Ross is an Anchorage attorney who's been very active in fighting for conservative causes. His nickname is War, as in Wayne Anthony Ross. He drives around town, or did, in a big Hummer. He wears a big cowboy hat. He's a big man. He actually is quite charming. And if you met him, he's much milder in person than some of his rhetoric would indicate. Not only had he made disparaging and perhaps ugly, and I think ugly, remarks about gay people, he went to war with Alaska's indigenous people over some native rights questions that involved arcane questions, at least they would be for your listeners, of hunting and fishing rights. So he had probably 16% of the population, that's the native Alaskan native or indigenous people part of the population, against him to begin with. And I've known Wayne a long time. I like Wayne. If you spend any time with him, he's a very likable fella. But he went down to Juneau to testify before the legislature, and he just couldn't shut up. He just kept talking and talking and talking and talking. And what all that talking did about his views was digging and digging and digging and digging, digging himself in deeper. And eventually he made some comments about the appointment of a state senator and how that process should work he should have just kept those remarks to himself. He made some other remarks that finally the legislature, just in their disgust with him, but even more so with their disgust with Sarah Palin, rejected him overwhelmingly. It was quite stunning, and it was quite amazing how quickly Wayne's stature among legislators collapsed. I think for some legislators, this would be a way of getting back at Sarah Palin for various things, especially among the Democrats. And there were a couple legislators, perhaps, who just took it out on Wayne because he'd been on the other side of them in political campaigns and other issues.
Tell us something about Sarah Palin's tenure as governor that you think is telling about her leadership style that most of us outside of Alaska wouldn't know about.
Well, for one thing, the absence of cabinet meetings, not that being a great leader requires cabinet meetings. As you know, many of those are pro forma and just television events, and not a lot gets done. But fundamentally, more than that, it would be just her sort of hands-off approach to governance. And I think there's been a certain amount of commentary on her of her lack of curiosity about a lot of things. I think the other thing would be that she's not the kind of person who would want to say, you know, I have this position. What does the other side in this say so I can really test my own arguments? And, you know, I might actually learn something from the people that disagree with me. She's not like that at all. On the other hand, I think that we discussed last fall this idea of affinity politics with her, that she has a tremendous appeal here and elsewhere among a certain class of voters who look at her and say, you're like me. You represent me and your values, how you conduct your life, the struggles that you have. In some ways, I think that's endeared her to some voters. I have some friends in Fairbanks who traveled the South during the winter. And everywhere they went, when people saw their Alaska license plates, people wanted to know, do you know Sarah Palin personally? I think she's wonderful. On the other hand, I was in Manhattan in January, and I told people I was from Alaska and had to personally defend myself, at least verbally, from people who were hysterical because they couldn't stand Sarah Palin. They somehow thought it was my fault.
Do you think Sarah Palin actually has aspirations to be president, or do you think she's leaving politics, or do you have no idea?
Boy, that's a really good question. I had wondered if she'd just say after what happened to her on the national tour, I'm getting out of politics altogether. I mean, I thought that was a possibility, and it's still a possibility. On the other hand, she has been enthusiastically received in many places. Todd Purdom describes the reception she got at, in Evansville, Indiana, from a select audience of people of like-minded philosophy. And, you know, if you see people who agree with you day in and day out, you can get a pretty good opinion of yourself and develop hey, lightning may strike, I may win, or maybe God is sending me. I got several emails from people who said, Sarah Palin is God's agent, and you better get with the program, Carrie.
Would you list what you consider to be two of Sarah Palin's top achievements during her tenure as governor?
Well, first of all, it remains to be seen what's going to come out of her gas line proposal, but there is still an opportunity. She has set up a structure for building a gas line from the North Slope of Alaska to deliver gas to the Midwest market. And if that actually occurs, although it's going to unfold over a period of time that will include a period of time when she's not governor, that would be a significant legacy. She did participate in the raising of oil taxes and rewriting the ethics laws. But those were before she became governor, and I think legislators and even her staff would be hard-pressed to come up with a much of a list of performance-related successes after she came back here. I notice on this list that she put out of accomplishments, she lists transfer more control of public issues to the local level. Well, what does that mean?
What do you think it means?
I have no idea because she cites no specific example.
With the Sarah Palin resignation and all the mystery surrounding that and the scandal that forced Ted Stevens out of his position as state senator, is this a weird time for Alaskan politics?
It's a very weird time in Alaskan politics. Is the FBI going to continue its investigation of legislators and others here in Alaska? You may have noticed, and listeners may have noticed, that the FBI here in Anchorage, Eric Gonzalez, the agent spokesman, denied categorically that they were investigating Sarah Palin. I talked to Agent Gonzalez today, and he said the phone was ringing off the hook with people who had heard from bloggers and others that Palin was about to be indicted. And the FBI, which rarely responds to those kind of things, finally just said, we're going to tell them it's not true. And they did that. But yes, and it's going to be fascinating to see the candidates for governor, what they tell Alaskans they represent in contrast to Sarah Palin.
Any final thoughts you want to leave us with about Sarah Palin and the impact that she's had on your state, Alaska?
She is the biggest celebrity in the history of Alaska. She is the best-known Alaskan ever, far bigger than Ted Stevens, who was a U.S. senator for 40 years, far, far bigger than anybody who's ever been a governor. Most of the governors here would be only regionally known, if at all, or Steve Cooper became known somewhat during the oil spill. That probably is her legacy, is as the biggest celebrity we've ever produced. And that's the world that she operates in. Why she left, I think we can only find out here in a period of time. Will she go on to some television gig? Will she stay home and work on her book? Is she going to be a presidential candidate? We're going to find out, but it's unfortunate. But I think what we have to say here is the proverbial more information needed.
Well, Michael Carey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michael Carey is a columnist and former editorial page editor for the Anchorage Daily News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are the creators of the new HBO comedy series Hung, the husband and wife team Dimitri Lipkin and Colette Burson. Lipkin also created the series The Riches. Hung stars Thomas Jane as Ray Drecker, a former high school sports star who's now a high school basketball coach. He's had a rough couple of years. His wife divorced him, then there was his kidney stone and the prostate scare, and on top of all that, his house burned down in an electrical fire and he's trying to rebuild it. Meanwhile, he's camping out in his backyard, which is why his twin teenage children decided to leave him for their mother's house. Ray's job doesn't pay much, and he's desperate. He eventually figures out he has something he can market, himself, as a prostitute, because he's very well endowed. The idea comes to him at a motivational seminar led by a speaker who says he can help you become a millionaire by finding your winning tool.
What about you, Ray? Have you considered your winning tool?
Yeah, I've considered it. I think I know what it is. What I'm trying to figure out is how to market it. Because what I'm discovering is that...
Slow down, Ray. Before we can help you with your dream, we have to know what it is. You have to pitch it to us.
I'm not in the mood to pitch tonight, Floyd, and I really don't think it's something for the group.
Now, what Ray is going through is very normal. Fear. It's a common stumbling block. But the way to overcome it is to acknowledge it. Validate it. And keep on going. Damn the torpedoes. Now, without thinking about it, tell me, Ray, say it. What is your winning tool? Yeah, no, without thinking about it, say it. My name is Ray, and I've
got a big Floyd. All right. I've got a big Now, what the hell do I do with the damn thing? I'm not that smart. Not that talented. Anymore, anyway. I wasted my youth, and now I look around and everybody seems to have accomplished something but me. I don't have anything. I got a burnout house, a job that pays can't afford to pay my taxes on time. So, I'm pretty much at the precipice here. Got any advice for me?
Okay, I didn't actually say that. I said I was good with old cars. Wanted to be a mechanic. What a crock.
So that's a scene from the new HBO series Hung. Dimitri Lipkin, Colette Burson, welcome to Fresh Air. In the story, you know, it's the guy who's the prostitute, because he's really down on his luck and he's well endowed, so he can sell himself. And Tanya, the Jane Addams character, who's also attending the self-improvement motivational seminar, she becomes the pimp. She's actually a poet who's made a little bit of money working in the Poets in the Schools program, but that's not very lucrative. So she wants to use her abilities as a writer to help him market himself and, of course, keep some of the profits. So this is a story in which it's the guy that's the prostitute and the woman that's the pimp. So what kind of opportunities does that create for you as writers?
I think a lot of what Hung deals with is men's view on women and women's view on men. Many times I think of it as men and women staring at each other across a room and what they think of one another. And that was also a very interesting point that we would discuss at length with Alexander Payne. Just
who directed the pilot.
Yes, the male perspective on this situation and the female perspective on this situation. And every time that we're shooting a scene where Ray goes into a room and shuts the door and he's there alone with a woman, I'm always reminded of how electric that situation is. Like, at the end of the day, it's a man and a woman alone together in a room and what they think of each other and what they think of one another sexually. And there's something very charged about that before they ever open their mouths.
One of the basic things I think you had to ask yourself in writing Hung is how important really is how well a man is endowed for women? Do women really care? Does it make a difference? Did you talk about that, and did you agree on that when you were starting to write the series?
I think we agreed on the idea that that Ray thinks it's fairly important to be well endowed, to please women.
And then as time went on, we made the decision that for each woman who encounters Ray's penis, it is the perfect member for her. Any woman who sees it really loves it. We don't think of Ray as being some gargantuan-sized guy, like not like some Guinness Book of World Records freak show. We think of him as being the most hung guy in the room, the most hung guy in his high school, the most hung guy on the basketball court, and that you know imbues him with a certain confidence. At the same time, we do feel, you know, part of what goes on in the show is that Ray, that's not enough. You know, Ray has quite a lot to learn about the
ladies.
Well,
that's what I was going to add, we make it pretty clear that that's just a very small aspect of his sexuality, and he's got a lot to learn about women.
As Tanya says to him, you could learn a little more about foreplay. Like she gently suggests to him, and other women also suggest that he has a lot to learn.
I'm wondering what the auditions were like for the Ray character, the character who is hung and decides that that's the part of him that is most saleable. Did people show up wearing like real stud clothes to impress you? What did it look like?
Well, we had a lot of auditions.
400 people?
Like so many people, lot, yeah. Hundreds. Alexander's a real believer in the audition process. And so we sat through a whole lot. I mean, literally hundreds of versions of that monologue that you see in the Make Money seminar. And I remember being quite interested about how different male actors would deal with it. Like some would spread their legs and kind of point to their crotch. Some would just sit in a chair with their legs spread in this very sort of cocky way. Others would be very sort of insecure and you know, take that aspect of it. It was quite fascinating to watch the different male takes on that audition process.
But almost none of them did it simply. They had to do something with it, you know. They couldn't take the lines for what they were, which is a kind of a matter. It's a simple statement that he makes, which I think is the most moving choice of all.
How did Thomas Jane do it?
He did it simply. It's who he is. It's what he has.
He also interrupted himself during the monologue and would stop and start again. And he really kind of felt his way through it as an actor. And I think Alexander and we were all quite drawn to how he kind of stopped when it didn't feel true and then just sort of felt his way through it in a very honest, simple way.
I feel like I should say to our listeners, like, in spite of the fact that there's a lot of sex, this is a TV series that's really about characters. It's really about people and motivations and their inner lives and desires. Do you always feel like you have to make both of those things straight when you describe the show to potential viewers?
We don't feel like we have to make it straight. Well, we feel like... What do we feel, Dimitri? We don't often find ourselves explaining the show to viewers.
Yeah, we feel like we have these very unique and peculiar characters that we follow truthfully, and yes, Ray does fall into having sex with women for money, but I don't know. We feel like we
feel like it's not cheeseball. Like feel like if someone turns on the TV and watches our show, that there's a lot that they'll be drawn in. That like we'll grab the Rays, we'll grab the Tanyas.
Dimitri, since this is the second show that you've pitched to a network, tell us a little bit of what the pitch process is like. Maybe let's go back to The Riches, which was the first time you had a successful TV pitch. Were you prepared for it? Did you know what to do?
Well, you know, in the pitch process, it's you really want to connect with your executive that you're trying to sell it to by telling a story that they ideally something they read about a couple years ago and have mostly forgotten. And so I remember.
So I started talking about this woman who was who was caught on tape beating up her daughter at a Kmart parking lot. It's a story that came out maybe about 7 years ago.
And the woman was a traveler.
And it turned out the woman was a traveler. So that's how I started. And then I linked it to myself. I linked it to my experience as an immigrant. I came here from Russia when I was 10, and I grew up in Louisiana. And I always looked at America through that prism, through the prism of being an outsider, and I wanted to write have a television show that looks at America, from the outside in, but at the same time had a more, not just an immigrant story, but also a story about, people who do illegal things and try to kind of steal the American dream. So that's I did approach it from that kind of thematic point of view as well.
Dimitri, describe what it means to be a traveler, what a traveler is.
A traveler is an Irish. Gypsy, who it's a very small, very kind of insular clan of these people who travel around the United States in RVs, and very little is known about what they do. But they it is said that they rely a lot on conning on scams and cons to make their money.
Now, Dimitri, you grew up in Russia. You're Jewish. And when you immigrated with your parents when you were 12, was it?
10.
10. You moved not to a place like Brighton Beach, which has a really large Jewish-Russian emigre community. You moved to Baton Rouge, not famous as far as I know for its Russian-Jewish emigre community. Why Baton Rouge?
There was absolutely no reason for it. We had no relatives at that time in the United States. We were the first ones to leave Russia, and my dad is a chemical engineer. So what happened in that process in the late 70s is that a Russian Jewish refugee family would get matched with a Jewish community somewhere in the States. And it was there was some reason to it because my dad is a chemical engineer. They thought perhaps Louisiana oil, he can get a job there, which he did. But it was also a bit of a fluke. I could have been anywhere. And we were the second second Russian Jewish family in Baton Rouge at the time.
And Dimitri, did being Jewish mean any more or less to you when you left Russia and moved to the United States?
Well, I was vaguely aware of the fact that I was Jewish in Russia, just because there's no opportunity to go to have any kind of a religious freedom. When I came to the States, part of the reason for coming was sort of to was to embrace your new identity. And so yes, we did go I became very aware that I was Jewish once I got to to Louisiana. I had a bar mitzvah. I was actually circumcised, and I was for a while I was actually quite it was a Reformed temple, but I did definitely embrace that identity.
Now, Colette, before doing Hung, you wrote and directed a kind of neglected comedy called Coming Soon. And it's like a teen sex comedy, but most of these teen sex comedies are from the boys' point of view. This is from the girls' point of view, from the point of view of girls who are with boys who have who know how to get pleasure themselves but have no idea how to give it to the girls they're with and don't seem to really care either. And I'm wondering what gave you the idea of doing, a kind of teen sex comedy from the point of view of the girls?
You know, probably just conversations with women that I'd had, you know, from in college and moving into graduate school. And I was also very struck when I came to New York City to go to NYU at how different the adolescence of my peers at school had been, the ones who grew up in Manhattan, compared to my own sort of 1950s high school experience in a small town in Virginia. And so I was drawn to that difference and drawn to just how they dealt with sexuality in high school. And, you know, it's funny because Coming Soon has sexual content and Hung has sexual content. And I don't really think of myself as being obsessed with sexual content. And yet, if you know, there's all this work of mine that has it. And actually, just when you posed that question, I thought, you know, it's interesting. Maybe the link is the female point of view, because I do think that's something that I really think of a lot in Hung. And that's definitely something that was going on in Coming Soon.
And so what's the connection and how you think about it? Are you thinking about, like, what?
Well, just the female point of view. I mean, I felt that when I was dealing with the teen comedy genre, that there were so many teen comedies from the boys' point of view, and that no one was really dealing with what it was like to have sex when you were in high school, as so many teenage girls do. And I think they're left in this state of confusion and thinking that being left completely unfulfilled is a natural state of being. You know, that's just sort of how it is. I think that's the discovery. And so I really wanted to speak to that. And then in terms of Hung, I feel like, I am bringing a certain female perspective. I'm fascinated in that I feel like when men watch episodes of Hung and when women watch episodes of Hung, I've come to realize that they're watching very different things. When I watch Hung, I'm watching Ray, and I'm thinking of Ray's experience as he goes through it. And I was surprised to realize, talking to Dimitri and the male writers and others, that they're watching the different women that Ray encounters. So they're very aware of which woman he's about to have sex with or thinking of having sex with and what it would be like to have sex with her. And I'm not thinking of that at all. I'm really focused on the man in it. And someone told me that that's a lot like old romance novels when they were written for men, that that a romance novel that's written for a man goes through many women. And the classic Harlequin romance that is written for women focuses on one male character that, you know, the woman is trying to get the attention of. So it's interesting.
So, Dimitri, I'm not sure if I should be asking you this or not, but if you got circumcised after you moved to the United States at the age of 10...
We know it.
Yeah, it's not something probably a lot of boys would want to go through. Was it all right?
Well, our playwriting mentor, Eduardo Machado, keeps saying that that's the reason I became an artist. I don't know. It was a bit of a shock to go through. Perhaps somewhat traumatic.
And wasn't there a rabbi there? And there was this whole ceremony. Like, I always think of it as Dimitri sort of feeling like he was stepping up to reclaim his Jewish ancestry from, you know, the ash heap of being lost in Russia. And it seemed like a noble act for a young man to do.
Yeah, I was out for that whole thing when the rabbi was there doing when I was reclaiming my Jewish identity.
But nevertheless, didn't you tell me
total anesthesia?
But nevertheless, Dimitri, didn't you tell me that you volunteered?
I did volunteer. Yes, I really did embrace my Jewish heritage when I came from Russia to the States.
Do you think it affected you as a writer to grow up with one language and at the age of 10 start learning a second language, the language that you ended up writing in?
Absolutely. Because I think for years I was, you know, all I had to do was observe people who are surrounded by, I think, you know, who are very much within the place where they're from. They're not quite as self-conscious, so it doesn't they don't nurture that quality of observation as much as I think with people who grew up as outsiders.
Kate Wolbert's novel Our Kind was nominated for the National Book Award in 2004, and her earlier novels and short stories have also attracted critical acclaim. The cheeky title of Wolbert's new novel is what caught our book critic's eye. It's called A Short History of Women. Here's Maureen Corrigan's review. Well, it is short, but it's not sweet. Kate Wolbert's melancholy novel, A Short History of Women, documents the inner lives of five generations of women, beginning in the 1880s and ending in the present. If families can be said to genetically pass on emotional colorings, the way hair and eye colorings are passed on, then the Townsend clan carries forward a dominant tendency toward passionate renunciation. The British matriarch of the family, Dorothy Trevor Townsend, was a suffragist who went on a hunger strike in 1914. She starves herself on principle to make something happen. She was buried, her daughter tells us, in a simple box, a lavender Votes for Women sash across her small, unquivering bosom. That daughter, Evelyn, sternly closes the lid on the memory of her mother's martyrdom. She eventually emigrates to America and becomes a professor of chemistry at Barnard College, devoting herself to science and resolutely tamping down her desire for intimate relations with other humans. But at the end of her life, Evelyn hollowly muses, "It only goes so far, your work." The message of the Townsend family lies in repetition. In the next generation, Evelyn's niece, also named Dorothy, is a wife and mother of three who divorces her husband after 50 years of a rather listless marriage, takes to wearing only black and white clothes, and becomes politicized in her old age. She's arrested in 2003 for taking clandestine photos of soldiers' coffins at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. This Dorothy is regarded as kind of an annoying kook by her two adult daughters, who themselves live in a state of post-9/11 repressed dread. Given its jaundiced attitude towards women's activism and the transformative possibilities of social change, A Short History of Women might be subtitled, "Damned if you do, damned if you don't." That's a risky message for any novel that wants to be widely read to embrace. To give Wolbert her due, she's no spinner of feminist fairy tales. Indeed, she's ruthless in dramatizing the limited, mostly disappointing solutions each successive generation of Townsend women arrives at in answer to what used to be called the woman question, or as one of the Dorothys puts it, the problem of us. Wolbert is also ambitious in the way she tells her story. The narrative bops around chronologically in a style that might be thought of as Virginia Woolf taking shorthand. The lives of the Townsend women intersect with larger events in 20th century history: VJ Day, 1970s consciousness-raising sessions, the aforementioned 9/11, and Wolbert beautifully evokes the moods of those various times with a few spare sentences. But, and you must have known there was a but coming here, A Short History of Women ultimately slips into the category of novel that I admire but don't like. Maybe it's the overall sense of suffocation, the way Wolbert's story elegantly loops around, repeating scenes and conveying the implicit political message that the more things change, the more they stay the same. One after another, her women succumb to quiet deaths of body or spirit through starvation, drinking, emotional denial. It's all so measured, so beautifully wrought. The most affirming finale here belongs to the second Dorothy, who goes ungently into that good night, blogging her feminist anger out into the ether. Blogging. It's a realistic and restrained ending, of course, but by the end of Wolbert's novel, I was ready for a good old mid-cult catharsis. Instead of blogging, I wanted somebody to throw a brick. Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Short History of Women by Kate Wolbert. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.